This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Colonel Ann B. Smith of the U.S. Army. Today's date is the 29th of June, 2004. I am in the interview room in Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, and I am speaking with Colonel Smith by telephone. She is in Alabama. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to resume with the place that we left off last session, which involves your posting as a recruiting officer in Virginia in, I think, 1954. Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, at that time, there were separate WAC recruiting officers, and they had one of us at every one of the recruiting stations across the United States. And it was just a part of the assignment. Everybody did it.
Really?
Uh-huh. I can't think of anybody I knew who didn't have an assignment on recruiting. And so from Fort McClellan, Alabama, I went to Roanoke, Virginia, which is a beautiful area.
Yes, it is.
But not the best recruiting area for young women, particularly at that time.
Now, why do you say that, Ann?
Well, the Army was not a job of choice for a lot of people then, especially for young women in a fairly conservative area.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given a quota of women to recruit. I don't think I ever made the quota. And it wasn't big, but we were supposed to try to recruit that many.
Now, how would you actually go about this? Would you rely on people, women actually walking in to the office?
Well, the majority of the contacts were made with the male recruiters who were, back up a minute, there
sure.
was one officer and one woman NCO assigned to every one of the, at least, assigned to every one of the major recruiting stations.
Mm-hmm.
And so the major contacts were by the male recruiters who were out in the various regions. They, we covered from the whole western part of Virginia, so that was set up into districts or sections
mm-hmm.
with a male recruiter. They were the ones who went into the high schools
mm-hmm.
and contacted the people, and then frequently they would call and ask me to go somewhere and talk to a high school group.
Okay.
And it was sort of interesting because at that time we were into the taupe uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And the young women were usually interested on what I wore underneath.
No kidding.
So I had a bright red slip with lace on the bottom. And I would heist my skirt a little bit and show them what I wore underneath.
Now, this was part of your unique recruiting approach?
Yes, that was
approach.
Part of it, my attention getting.
Now, how effective was this put together with the other? The
it
other
didn't make any recruits, to... but it got the interest.
So you never made your quota, Anne?
Never. And I remember one time I was out really in the mountains of West Virginia in the
mm-hmm.
coal mining area,
mm-hmm.
and I was talking to a young high school graduate that one of the recruiters had found, and I asked, if you don't go in the Army, what would you do? She said, oh, I'll probably teach school. So that says something at that time
mm-hmm.
about the society. Plus,
yes.
Another thing was, at that time, the Army had higher enlistment standards for women than for men on the various placement tests, and they had to be older. They couldn't have any type of police record. And it was hard for the young women, it was hard for a lot of the young men and for the young women to make the minimum score. And I frustrated the male sergeants because I wouldn't give points. They would say, well, she doesn't need but 2 points. I said, if she can't make the minimum,
mm-hmm.
I just can't do it. So that discouraged them.
Right. You weren't fluffing up the numbers
no.
in order to...
If the minimum score, the cutoff score was 31,
mm-hmm.
and if it was 29 or 30, I just wouldn't fudge it.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me a little bit about this differential in the standards for men and women. What did that arise from? What was the thinking behind it?
Well, they needed more men than women.
Yes. So So the floodgates were opened a little bit wider for the guys to be.
Yes, I can't remember what the scores were, but I know that there was a decent differential between the men and the women. I remember the women was 31, but and so that did make a difference. And depending on the education level of the people, mm-hmm. where you were, you were. Also, the job market, even then, but the Army was not the most attractive thing to young women then.
Right, in terms of socially and in terms of...
Well, it was such a foreign notion to them, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. The publicity was not what it is today.
Right.
The gimmicks were not as good.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't as many good things to come, like education and some of the commitments, enlistment commitments that they have now. So it's a different world.
Were there also some discrepancies between rural areas and the more urban areas in terms of educational standards that the students broadly, both men and women, were expected to meet, such that that had some impact, too, on success in meeting that 31 minimum standard?
Well, just the quality. That's not to say that rural schools are always bad.
True, very true.
Because some of them are better than big city schools.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, absolutely.
At least today.
Yes, absolutely. That's certainly the case. And always has been. I think there are always exceptions to understood or observed results.
Yeah.
Anne, did you have success with particular groups? So those women that you were successful in recruiting, did you have, for example, more whites than blacks or more older women in their early 20s?
That escapes me.
Okay. Okay. Did you have any success?
Very little.
Okay. Now, this posting did not lead to another recruiting assignment for you.
Definitely not.
Okay. Okay.
And usually we didn't get but one.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, because there was always a new bunch coming in mm-hmm. to do it.
Okay. And everybody in the Corps pretty much had to do this at least once.
Yeah. Well, in my era,
uh-huh.
and I don't know, if you go back to the early days, I doubt that that was so.
Okay.
And certainly it ceased later on, but it was pretty much just part of a career path.
Mm-hmm.
You trained trainees, and you went on recruiting, and then you did something else.
Okay. And was the Corps, at this point, after you're having the recruiting assignment, beginning then to shape what area you would specialize in, since you had done the things that pretty much each junior officer had to do?
Well, there were a lot of other steps that we had to take.
Okay.
Like serving in a WAC detachment, a lot of us. That was a next step.
Okay. And that, in fact, is what happened with you, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Well, I was first, when I left recruiting, I was sent to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, to be the executive officer in a WAC detachment at Fort Sheridan. And when the commander left, I became the commander.
Okay.
And that was a path, too. You served time as exec, to sort of on-the-job training,
yes.
And then normally somewhere you were assigned then as a WAC detachment commander.
Now, and you filled that role, both of those roles, both XO and commander at Fort Sheridan?
Yeah, and I was WAC detachment commander a couple of other places, too.
And those would be which places, Anne?
I left Sheridan and went to Fort Riley, Kansas for a short time, mm-hmm. and then went to Bremerhaven, Germany.
Okay. Let's talk first of all about Fort Sheridan. What was the personnel complement of the WAC detachment? How big was it, and what responsibilities did you have as XO?
I would guess, I don't remember, but probably between 60 and 80.
Okay. And
well, as the exec, I did everything the commander didn't want to do. That's one thing. And we had people who worked in different areas of the post. We had a post hospital, mm-hmm. and there were enlisted women who worked there. We had a a processing, I can't remember the name of it, but I had a great number of women who worked there. We had an air defense command on post, so they were scattered all around.
Sure, uh-huh.
And one of my next-door neighbor was the mail company, headquarters company, and I ran their mess hall.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it was, now why they set it up that way, I don't know, but all the troops ate in that mess hall. All the cooks belonged to the mail company commander, but they worked for me. And at that time, women could not command men. They could only command women.
Right, right. And so
I'm remembering things I thought I'd forgotten.
But it's very, you know, this exercise of explaining it to someone who, you know, may not have any reference points is quite good because, you know, it lays things out in this very clean way. You had then women who were in the detachment who were serving all across the base.
Yes.
In lots of different capacities.
I was responsible for their discipline and upkeep. You know, I housed them and fed them,
mm-hmm.
and I had some disciplinary authority over them.
Now, what kinds of disciplinary issues might come up?
Oh, I'm trying to think of a good example.
Mm-hmm. For example, were there hours that had to be observed and curfews?
Well, they had to sign in and out, for example.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And really, women were very little problem. Every now and then you would have somebody who might go AWOL. The biggest problem probably at that time was pregnancy.
Uh-huh.
That wasn't a discipline problem. I don't
right.
mean that.
Sure.
But it was an administrative problem because married or single, if you were pregnant, you could not stay in the Army.
Right, so you had to process those women out?
Yeah. We had to realize they were pregnant. Then we had to get them to admit it.
Okay.
And then if they were single, we worked very hard to find a place for them to go.
Now, by place for them to go, what do you mean?
Like a shelter,
mm-hmm.
like a home for unwed mothers so they could have the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of that sort of thing that went on that we were supposed to take care of.
And did you, or when you were detachment commander, your XO, have to have sort of networks in the communities around the post such that you knew where there would be, say, a Crittenden home or something like that?
Now, the Red Cross was a big help in that.
Okay, uh-huh.
And, but we were in very close to, at that time, very close to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So there were assets there, and you made the initial contact or directed the people there. But that was probably the biggest problem we had to deal with.
Now, the women who were in the Corps would know that if they became pregnant, that would be the end of their
yes.
military career. And I don't know whether you might know this or not, Anne, but were women seeking some other way to resolve the issue of their pregnancy before being found out, quote unquote? In other words, were they having abortions? And
not that I know of.
Okay. Okay. It probably was very difficult to, sort of work with these women who were, you know, in a position that was very difficult and untenable as far as their continuing career.
It was, and several of them married,
mm-hmm.
And then got out. So, but some of them just had no other recourse.
Mm-hmm. Now, were there any gals who had other disciplinary issues? You mentioned one or two times, maybe finding women who were absent without leave. But
well, there was. Not only did I house the women who were assigned to Fort McClellan, if anybody got picked up in the Chicago area and was pending some type of disciplinary action or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
I got them to sleep and stay in my place, in my detachment. And
I see. Uh-huh.
I had one who would go into Waukegan and get drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And the police would call me And the MPs on post and the police in Waukegan learned that the first thing I would say when they woke me up at night is, what time is it? So they would usually start off, Lieutenant Smith, it's 2 o'clock, whatever. And so several times I went in to Waukegan to get people out of jail because they would release them to me.
I see, uh-huh.
And but they never were the women assigned to me. They were the ones who were already in trouble and were pending some type of either administrative discharge. And they were just different, but it was interesting.
Yes, because you became the sort of the troubleshooter then for other other commanders whose people these actually
were.
These
people could have been from Fort Hood, Texas,
yes,
for all I knew. They just wound up in the Chicago area, and we were the holding area.
Now, if you would get a woman out of jail under these kinds of circumstances, how would you pass her? How would she pass out of your, authority or control?
When she was discharged.
So you would hold on to her until then?
Yeah.
Okay.
But usually it was in the process to begin with.
Mm-hmm. It was already in train.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Because that's the only reason I had her, because she was there to be put out of the Army.
That sounds a little fraught with you getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning and driving into... Did you go alone on these missions, or did you have to...
Sometime I went alone. One time I took one of the male sergeants with me because... And when we got to the jail, I decided I never wanted to be in jail, looking at the conditions. And I was about to get her out and take her back with me.
Mm-hmm.
And she told the sergeant he could go to hell, so I told her she could stay in jail and get herself out.
Bad move.
Uh-huh.
That was a bad move, yeah. Any idea whatever happened with her?
She got out.
Eventually.
I think she got bail somewhere. She got sober, too.
Oh, gosh.
I don't make light of this, really.
No, I know. It was. I'm sure that each one of these was trying in some way.
Yes.
And Anne, I wonder if there were also circumstances where you had any lesbian activity inside either the detachment or up in Chicago, that you had to handle that situation too?
Yes, but really it was at that time, that was in the days of the witch hunts.
Mm-hmm.
And the witch hunts were just terrible because anybody who got mad at somebody could make an accusation, and it would, like any witch hunt.
Sure.
And I found that the best thing to do, and the woman who was a commander when I was exec, gave me some good advice. She said, get to know the people in the CID.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can help, because they have contacts and can say that, this probably is going on, but it wasn't rampant the mm-hmm. way people would think.
Right. And the CID people would be handling investigations,
yes,
that might be ongoing.
And sometimes they were handling one that we didn't even know about. And
mm-hmm.
I would say, do you know anything about this? And they would say yes, and there's nothing to it.
So so the advice that you had was to sort of work as a team with
yes.
the CID people?
It could make life a lot easier if they knew you and knew you would cooperate and weren't fighting them all the way.
Mm-hmm.
One night, a young woman woke up one morning and found herself in a car, and she didn't know how she got there, and she didn't know what had happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been out, and she was really worried about it. She came in and talked to me about it, and I went to see the people at the CID, and I said, can you find out what happened? And they came back and said, nothing happened. Tell her she's okay. So that sort of symbiotic relationship helped.
Yeah, and was that something that you tried to cultivate in your other postings too?
Yeah, if I were commander of a WAC detachment, I did.
Now, Anne, tell me about the the sense, you said these, that the witch hunts were terrible and that rumors could fly all around, and that that would be one way to, that someone who was disgruntled maybe might, you know, go after or cause trouble for someone with, someone else. Can you, do you remember any kinds of incidents where that sort of thing happened?
It was particularly bad at, like, the training center where all the women were. There was always suspicion, and you had to be exceedingly careful about your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And your. I know of times that it happened, but I can't come up with specifics.
And that suspicion that was around, in, that just kind of in the air, must have, I mean, that must have created difficulties for commanders, for officers, junior officers, to sort of sort out things.
It made it difficult for anybody.
Yeah.
Because it was just, was a bad time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And I imagine anybody of my era would say that it was a bad time.
Yes, I think that's probably right. When you had orders to go to Germany, do you remember that? Can you tell me about getting those orders?
Well, I had left Fort Sheridan and gone to Fort Riley. A commander there had been relieved, and I was ready for a transfer anyway, so they sent me there to just hold on till the new white detachment commander could come in.
Okay.
And I don't remember how long I was there, maybe
uh-huh.
5-6 months.
Uh-huh.
And so that was just a holding pattern.
Sure.
But and it was a different place entirely because it was a combat arms post and there were a lot more troops. But I, you know, it was a fine bunch of women. And so when I got orders to go, well, I remember that they called and told me. There was always a they who called you.
Right, right.
And they, there was, we had what was called career management branch.
Mm-hmm.
And so they made all the assignments, and it was done in cooperation with the White Director's Office.
Okay, so this was just within the Women's Army Corps.
Just within the Women's Army
mm-hmm.
Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And they, so she called and said, we want you to go to Okinawa to command the White Detachment there. And it was, please don't throw me in the briar patch time. I did not want to go to Okinawa.
Why was that, Ann?
Well, it was a hard assignment. The reputation was that it was a hard assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I instead went to Bremerhaven, Germany. And it proves that sometimes you can control your fate a little bit.
Had you informally or formally voiced your reluctance about the Okinawa idea?
Yeah, I told them I didn't want to go. Please send me somewhere else. I don't remember my words exactly.
What had you heard? Do you remember that turned you off?
That it was a difficult detachment to command.
That the detachment had
yes.
problems? Okay.
And I can't remember what they were. I
mm-hmm.
just knew I did not want to go.
Okay. Did you know anything about Bremerhaven?
No.
Well, that was good. So when that came up, you thought, well, clean sheet. And, you...
and when I got uh-huh. there, one of the best things about it was that the first sergeant of the detachment was a woman I had worked with at Fort McClellan.
Who was that?
Her name was Eva Morofsky. She was a German citizen
uh-huh.
and had come to the United States after World War II. She met a WAC officer who sponsored her to come to the United States.
Uh-huh. She sounds like an interesting gal.
Oh, she is fascinating.
Wow, and yeah.
She was a platoon sergeant with training basic trainees with me.
Mm-hmm.
And she would get up in the morning and go out to drill and say, all right, women, this is Monday. And on Monday, we all start on our left foot. And she was wonderful to have in Germany because, you know, spoke the language, knew the way around, but she was on orders when I got there, and she tried to extend, and they wouldn't extend her because they had her posted to somewhere in the United States, so she left.
How long had she been in Germany? Any idea?
Oh, she had been there probably 2 years on that tour.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a good first sergeant, and I enjoyed having her there.
Do you remember much about her background in Germany, perhaps during the war or earlier?
She talked about it.
Did she?
She said she was in Hitler Youth because that was the way you got to participate in sports activities.
Sure.
And I think then later on, she said she was in the entertainment business. She was a dog trainer, and they did, you know, shows.
Mm-hmm.
And when they shut down entertainment, she was jobless, and she worked in a munitions plant, as I recall. And they, one of the things they did was clean shell casings so they could be reused. And she said there were German prisoners, I mean, Russian prisoners of war there.
Mm-hmm.
They had to do by, the prisoners of war had to do by hand what the Germans were doing by machine. And she said that when they could, they would take the prisoners' shells and clean them for them.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Hearing her, and she apparently was in a dangerous part of Germany during the war, but I think she had no animosity toward the Americans.
I'm sure if she was in a munitions factory, that would have been a target for bombing, for certain.
At one time, she bought a pineapple. We were at the commissary, and she bought a whole pineapple. I said, you know, and I was ragging her about
sure.
it. And she said, I can have it. You know, I want it, and I can have it. She said, when I was growing up in Germany, we were lucky if we got one orange at Christmas time.
She sounds like a fascinating person. Was she someone that you kept up with over the years?
I have seen her once or twice at reunions,
mm-hmm.
and I have no idea whether she's still with us. She was mm-hmm. living in Florida.
She sure sounds like quite a gal.
She was older than I
mm-hmm.
By some years, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, I'm glad you mentioned her. Well, first of all, let me ask you about Bremerhaven. Where did you actually live?
I lived in a BOQ.
Mm-hmm.
The WAC detachment was in the staging area, which was out in the port area where the ships came in. And then we lived over a series of BOQs on the dry side.
Oh, okay. Now, to clarify, you were the detachment commander.
Yes.
Okay. And what kinds of jobs and work did the women in the detachment do?
Generally, staff type jobs in the headquarters.
Okay.
Of the port.
And how many under your command in this detachment?
I can't remember.
The
Navy had a group of waves there, and they lived in the WAC detachment.
How many waves? A handful or quite
yeah,
a few?
Yeah, a handful.
Uh-huh.
And there was a naval officer, woman officer, who was sort of their mother superior.
Sure. So was she kind of the analog to your position? I mean,
yes,
uh-huh.
but she did not have command, but we worked together.
What rank did she hold, do you remember?
I think she was a full lieutenant.
Okay. And what was your rank at this point?
First lieutenant.
Okay.
I was promoted to captain.
While you were in Bremer?
While I was there.
Okay. So you're moving up the food chain.
Yes.
Pretty well. Despite that little problem with the quota back in Roanoke, apparently you'd been doing well since then.
Well, I was first lieutenant when I got there,
uh-huh.
a fairly new first lieutenant. And so, you know.
And what year did you actually get there? Do you remember, Ann?
Bremerhaven, 58.
58. And stayed until 60?
60.
Okay. And in general, were two-year assignments the rule?
Yes.
Okay. And go ahead, Ann.
Except for the WAC Center, they were usually about a year.
Oh, okay.
At the WAC Center. Some people stayed longer. But.
And did you enjoy being in Germany?
Very much. And I enjoyed being in the northern part because
yes.
there weren't, sounds strange, there were not a lot of Americans there. The Americans were down in the southern part of Germany, and we were in the British zone.
Mm-hmm.
So there were fewer Americans, and I think we saw, well, that's not true. We didn't see more of the real Germany, but it was a different environment. And we were close to Holland and close to Denmark.
Mm-hmm. Did you go up to Denmark, say, for example?
I was in Denmark twice.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, the Army wanted everybody to use their leave time. And I was one of these who wanted to save on, hold on to my leave time.
I can believe that. Mm-hmm.
And we could not cross a border, a national border, without a leave paper or a passport. We didn't have passports. The military didn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
So you could get a pass to go up for a day. So a lot of my trips were day trips.
Okay, because you weren't spending your leave time.
In addition, there were no other Army women officers there. So when I left, somebody had to be in command of the WAC detachment anytime I was, on
mm-hmm.
leave.
Mm-hmm.
So
did you have an XO?
No. I didn't have an XO.
Oh, wow.
The commander of the band always commanded the WAC detachment while I was gone, and I was put in command of the band when he was gone.
So you had a male commander who would step in for you when you were away?
Yeah, he would be just put on, given the job during my absence.
Right, if anything came up, he would be the one they would go to.
And we had all services there, so that was interesting. And
sure, absolutely.
On Armed Forces Day, we would have a parade with the Americans and the Germans and the British, Armed Forces Day parade, and that was always interesting.
Did the German military at that point have a women's corps of some kind?
No.
That's what I thought, yeah. Can you describe in general the relationship between your personnel and the German civilians? Did anything come up there that was problematical or that you remember as being particularly a good relationship?
There were some particularly fine German civilians who worked for the Army, I thought. And the relationships were generally quite good, I believe. I remember one time we had a bus that they went to work on, the women, to get from the staging area into the headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bus for them. And I heard I think the Germans were allowed to ride the bus. And I heard one of the women refer to him as Crouch one day,
mm-hmm.
and I got my back up over that.
Mm-hmm.
Told her that was not an appropriate way to talk about him.
Right.
But the relationships were generally good.
Did you see either in your detachment or more broadly amongst the American service personnel over their resentment towards the Germans?
No.
Not really, huh?
Uh-uh.
That's interesting. Any signs while you were there? This was about 13 years after the conclusion of the war. Did you see signs of the destruction of the war still in evidence?
Not a lot. The Germans were always working to repair things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it dawned on me that really it was such a short time after the war that I was there. I went to Berlin, and,
mm-hmm.
and there were some things that were left standing in Berlin the way they were.
But, yes, and still are there, yes.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
But I wasn't conscious of it in the northern part.
What took you to Berlin? Were you just wanting to see it, or
yeah.
did you have business down
there? I just went for an overnight trip.
Okay, and what impression did you have of Berlin? Did you go to, right downtown the Brandenburg area?
Yeah, and took a tour of the East Berlin.
Now, had the wall had not been put up yet?
Oh, heavens no.
Mm-hmm.
The difference was night and day in East and West. as far as the life and the people you saw. I was, when I was there, Germans were constantly out walking. They were spaziergang machen, taking walks, and nobody was on the streets in East Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It just looked like a sham town. It looked like a movie set with facades and nothing behind. Mm-hmm. And West Berlin was just alive with people.
And a lot of military personnel there out on the streets as well, American?
We didn't see them. We were in civilian clothes.
Oh, really?
It was okay. A big... When we crossed over into the zone, they took my ID card, and I felt almost naked without my ID card.
Because you're in civilian clothes and
yeah.
No military ID or anything?
Yep.
Yeah.
And they gave it back, but
sure.
Still.
Are there other things that you recall about your time in Germany that you'd like to include here? Was it a good assignment?
Yes, it was a good assignment. And I had friends, Air Force friends, who were in England, and I would go to visit them periodically. Mm-hmm. And he was a pilot, an aviator,
mm-hmm.
And periodically he had to fly so many hours to maintain his status. So every now and then he'd fly over and get me. And I would pay the landing fee. It cost you $50 to land a plane in the German airport or something like that.
Right.
And he'd come take me, and I'd go home and go over to England and see them for a while. And I went to Scotland,
mm-hmm.
Which I enjoyed very much. Edinburgh is one of the places I want to go again.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful city.
And I traveled in Spain. Bob, my friend, had to take a plane back to the United States. So his wife said, get a leave. And I said, where am I going? And she said, well, put everything on your leave papers, you know, Spain, Italy. She and their son and I took off in the car, and we flipped a coin to see whether we were going to Spain or Italy. And we went to Spain. Unfortunately, I hadn't put Portugal on my leave, so I couldn't get to Portugal.
Where did you go in Spain?
We went down the Costa Brava and then back over to Madrid.
It sounds wonderful. It sounds like a great time.
Not if you don't speak, nobody speaks Spanish.
How long were you there?
Oh, probably a week.
Oh, okay, okay. But were you being a tourist most of that time?
Oh, yeah.
Or, mm-hmm.
Went to lie in the sun.
Right. Bake out the chill a little bit, as they say.
She had been in England for 2 years and still had moss, I think.
Oh, I can well believe it. Having lived over there, I can well believe it.
But I enjoyed going to England, and I never got to London
mm-hmm.
because they were stationed at Burton Wood in Lancashire.
Mm-hmm. So they were up north.
Yes.
Yeah. Where it's, you know, as you say, very cold. And
but no, I never had seen, really had never seen birds pulling worms out of ground. And I sat one time in an officer's club and looked out the window, and the birds were just after the worms.
Huh.
It's too dry. Even when it rains here, birds don't get worms.
No, that's right. That's right.
And everything was so green.
Yes, it is. It's remarkable. It's a beautiful country. So you really took advantage of being in Europe.
To the extent that I could.
Sure. Was it slightly difficult for you to get orders back to the States after that?
Oh, no.
No?
What? An aside from my being in Europe, one morning I was changing trains in Paris and had time to go walk around,
mm-hmm.
and I was standing there just looking all around me, saying, Ann Smith from Quitman, Georgia, on the Champs-Élysées. The last place I ever expected to be growing up was in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the wonderful things about the Army,
absolutely.
The opportunities that it gave me,
yes.
To do things like that. And I was thinking, at the time, if I had taught school, mm-hmm. I would have spent 20 years to go to Europe for 2 weeks, making enough money. And there I was for 2 years.
Yeah.
The compliments of the Army.
And you were appreciating it at the time.
Oh, yes.
Not just in retrospect, but while you were actually there, you were thinking, wow.
Here I am. Me.
Yeah. Little small town Anne.
Yeah.
And
I had recounted that story to my brother, and he said he did the same thing the first time he went to Paris,
yes.
Many years later.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I know that feeling. You sort of can hardly, you need to pinch yourself or something, you can hardly believe it. And you were assigned back to Fort Eustis.
Yes.
How did that come about, and was this a good posting for you?
When I was told I was going to Fort Eustis, I was not happy at all.
Why was that?
Because I had been to Fort Eustis the time and seen it, and I did not think it was a nice place to be. Because it just wasn't, it wasn't an elegant post like Fort Benning or something like that. It was just over there.
Okay.
And the WAC staff advisor, every command had a WAC staff advisor.
Mm-hmm.
The WAC staff advisor in Germany said to me when I was complaining, she says, which is more important, the place or the assignment? Because it was going to be my first staff assignment. And she got my attention, and I said, the assignment is far more important. So I went to Fort Eustis as a personnel staff officer. Had a wonderful time. Enjoyed the post. It's very close to Williamsburg, and at that time, Williamsburg was still a tourist attraction, but not the way it is now. And, that's where we went to shop. I mean, Williamsburg was just a special place, but not the way it would be now. And I had a good job. I worked with really good people. They gave me an opportunity to learn. It was my first experience with working with civilians, and I learned to respect them very much. And so it was a very rewarding assignment.
Now, when you say that it was your first staff assignment, for someone who didn't understand that, the importance of that, can you just outline that?
Let me think. It is, that gets you into, for lack of anything better, a career path.
Mm-hmm.
That let me start learning to work in personnel and be an administrative officer. There comes a point we had to get out of that whack track of doing nothing but whack duty. And a good staff assignment was just an open door to bigger and better jobs, and it was a wonderful background.
Now, you were, if I understand correctly, and please correct me, you were working on the staff of the post with male officers.
Yes, I was working on the staff of the G1,
okay.
The personnel officer of post,
okay.
And there were, the boss was a colonel, there was a lieutenant colonel, deputy, and a captain, and a bunch of civilians. And we worked in the same headquarters with the commanding general.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to my advantage that I was, turned out to be the writer for the G1. And I wrote a lot of stuff, correspondence for the general signature. And so, I got good experience that way.
Now, how did the men treat you, Anne?
Quite well.
Any stuff around the edge that made you feel like less than or?
No.
Okay. So so quite collegial then.
Yes.
Within the command structure, obviously, but.
I think that any discrimination that I ever felt was institutional discrimination. It was not personal.
Okay. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, there was a limit, and there was a limit on how many women could be regular Army. That was one thing. But there was, in law, the law prescribed that there could be one woman colonel in the Army, and she was the Director WAC. And when she, if she ceased to be Director WAC and reverted, she reverted back to being a lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
That stopped promotions tremendously.
Oh, sure, right, yeah.
And so getting to be a captain was a pretty good career at that time. And, you know, majors were rare, and lieutenant colonels were just very rare. So when, during President Johnson's term, the legislation was changed, the restriction was taken off. It didn't say there will be women generals. It said there may be women generals. And so on one day, six women were promoted to colonel. And which opened it for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that discrimination was against all of us, and it was in the system. One time when I was single, people weren't allowed to go to the commissary. Only families could go to the commissary. That's another type of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But the pay was always the same.
So pay was not based on...
No, pay was based on your rank and grade, and that was it. A captain is a captain.
Okay. So pay across for males?
Of course, for the except the allowances for family.
Family, right. And
there were discriminations there.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a male officer could have a wife who was a millionaire and still draw her dependency allowance.
Yes.
A woman couldn't. She could, her husband could be completely dependent on her, and she couldn't claim him as a dependent.
Mm-hmm.
So those types of things were what I consider institutional.
Mm-hmm.
But I never had felt belittled because I was a woman.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I used to raise Cain when anybody would call me a girl. I'm not a girl.
Already been through that. Now I'm done with that.
Yes, especially when I was an old girl.
So you would, you know, if that came up, you would kind of hand that back to whoever gave it to you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I was truly fortunate in that first staff job because they let me learn and they helped me to learn.
And would you say that there was some mentoring going on as well?
Oh, yes.
That's interesting. And were you liking the idea of staying with personnel?
Yes.
Why was that?
It was more administrative, I think. I could have been... I was a personnel staff officer as opposed to a personnel operating officer.
Uh-huh.
And that distinction is probably too close, but it made a difference to me.
Because you felt more like you were at decision-making level rather than implementation or something
like that? I guess.
Okay. Uh-huh. You mentioned in the material that you provided, Anne, that your time at Fort Eustis coincided with the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes.
Did that have any effect on the work that was happening at the base? Or?
Oh, yes, because Fort Eustis is a transportation command,
mm-hmm.
and in addition to all the trucks and airplanes, we had a boat company, and they ran tugs, and we had people there who were qualified ocean-going tug
mm-hmm.
captains.
Mm-hmm.
So... Before the Cuban Missile Crisis started, they had all taken off and gone somewhere out in the Atlantic for a training exercise, and they just stayed there. They didn't come home for a long time.
Okay.
And I was leaving, or someone was bringing a footlocker into the BOQ, and the people living next door, her husband was off on the exercise, and when she saw that Foot Locker walking in, she thought that they had made a mistake and they were supposed to be bringing it to her house to pack up his things to send away.
Really?
So, but it was an interesting time.
Was it a frightening time? As you remember it?
It was a tense time. Mm-hmm. I think more than frightening. And we had to make a report to the chief of transportation in Washington every night. And I wound up being the one who knew more about the figures than anybody, so I made the report every night. It's the first time I've ever worked on a shift, and I worked the 4 to midnight shift, and I liked it because I was usually up around midnight anyway, so mm-hmm. I'd just go home and go to bed and then get up and have the whole day.
Right, and then go to work at 4.
To do things, you go to work at 4.
Uh-huh. Can you, if you remember, describe that report, what it was that you had to provide each evening during this time period?
We had to keep up with, there were very complicated statuses as to what category troops were in as far as readiness was concerned.
Okay.
And we had to keep up with the strength in each group. I could not come up with a good explanation, but it was whether they were immediately deployable, what their training status was, mm-hmm. and it was an everyday thing to report.
Mm-hmm. And that persisted for the length of the crisis?
Yeah, but I can't remember how long it was.
Okay. Uh-huh. Did you pay much attention to, say, the president's televised statements and the newspaper and everything that was going on that was in the public record? Were you aware and paying attention to that, reading the newspaper and so on?
I don't recall taking the newspaper then, mm-hmm. but I remember keeping up.
Okay. Was there other unusual activity on the base that you remember?
Not now. One of the things in my personal life was we had a very active little theater group there.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
And we had a lot of young, well-educated young men who had been drafted. And the director had a drama degree from Yale or someplace. I mean, they're just fine young people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to be in several plays. But that was true in Bremerhaven, too. They had a very active little theater.
Now, this was sort of an unofficial activity, I'm sure.
Yes.
How did enlisted people and other officers who might have been interested in this kind of find each other? Was it just kind of on the grapevine?
Well, it was a part of special services.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And one of the interesting things to me was I was one of the few officers who did that, and most of the other people were young enlisted men,
mm-hmm.
and there was no problem of dealing with his being the boss at night and my being an officer in the daytime. If they saw me in the rehearsal, I was Ann. Outside, yeah. I was captain.
Right. So rank never got kind of foiled up.
No.
With...
It
That's interesting.
It wasn't in the way, but it was always there.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Do you remember some of the productions you might have put on? Were they things that were written on the base? Or?
Oh, no.
They were actual plays. Like, would you do Tennessee Williams or something?
We didn't do Tennessee Williams, but we did do The Crucible.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that was in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And one of the interesting things about that was the dress rehearsal. We invited the German Navy, mm-hmm. Navy, and they came. And they were fascinated with the plot.
I'll bet. Arthur Miller would love to hear this story, I'm sure.
And I got to play the part of Elizabeth Proctor, and it was the only time I played someone who wasn't just another version of Ann Smith.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But that and that was very rewarding to be in that. And we did, Once Upon a Mattress, and Matchmaker, and just stuff.
It sounds like a great kind of thing to be doing outside of work.
It was. And it was quite popular.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
Because it was some place to go.
Yes.
It was free.
Uh-huh. Entertainment.
Yeah.
And I think, in general, people do like live entertainment. And people they knew, too. I mean, that's the other thing.
Yes.
So, now, were you able to continue with that kind of work as your career
no.
went on? So Fort Eustis was the last time, really, that you were able to do that?
Yeah, it was the last time I did it.
Okay. Upon the end of this particular tour, you were assigned back to Fort McClellan, is that right?
Yeah, to school. It was interesting. Yeah. You asked if I were mentored in that job when my boss, the colonel, found out that I would be going to McClellan to go to the advanced course. He said, well, you're going to have to write a staff study when you get there. And he assigned me the job of writing a staff study. Now, that type of mentoring.
Okay.
And it was a practical problem, but he wanted me to see how the staff study works and what you have to do. So
you would know. You would have some
So I would have
experience.
Had some experience. Uh-huh. And you appreciate things like
yes,
that.
Yes, absolutely. A heads up, as it were. What did you actually work on as your subject?
I don't remember.
No
what
kidding.
He told me to.
Whatever he told you to. Okay. Now, the school at Fort McClellan lasted for approximately how long?
6 months.
Okay. And what was the content? What were you supposed to be getting out of it?
Well, it was the WAC officer advanced course, and it was to train us more in staff-type assignments.
Okay. Was it a lot of classroom work then?
Oh, yes, all classroom work.
Mm-hmm. And who were the instructors? Were they both men and women?
They were all. Occasionally we would have an instructor come over from the chemical school to teach something, but generally it was all women.
And these would be women of what sort of rank?
Majors.
Majors and above?
Well, occasional lieutenant colonel, but most of them were majors.
Okay. Were any of them particular? Go ahead, Ann.
No. Captains, too.
Okay. I wondered if any of the instructors that you had there stand out in your mind.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
One of the ones who was one of the best Army instructors I ever had was a woman named Ruth King. She was a major, and she taught us nuclear weapons employment. And she was an outstanding instructor. And most of them were very good. There were one or two who weren't as effective as others. But it was... It was a fairly difficult course, and we had people in there, captains. We were all captains and majors in the course.
Was there anything you can recall about the content of that particular course? Was this an unclassified presentation?
Yes, it was unclassified, but in order to teach it, you had to have gone through the classified training. And so that was interesting because you were trying to forget everything you had learned.
Okay, right. Did you get some physics in with this as well as
only
Army protocols
to understand maybe what an atom is and what the difference between fission and fusion and what the effects are of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the effects of the weapons. There were problems in figuring how the weapon would affect an area based on theoretical weapons, you know, a half kiloton or something like that, that did not have the characteristics of the real half kiloton.
Yes, right. So you were seeing some of those theoretical problems as
yes,
well?
Yes, you were seeing how much the area of blast would be and how far it would reach and those types of things.
And did you also study the actual drops that had been made in Japan at the end of the war?
Well, not specifically.
Did you see films?
We saw some films, of mm-hmm. course. But
mm-hmm. What was it about Major King that made her particularly special?
She was enthusiastic. She knew the subject. She could teach. She could explain the concepts well.
Did you have occasion to work with her as your career went along, or was this your only interface with her?
Only time I ever was with her was when she taught me.
And overall, Anne, was this a useful way to spend some time for you as a captain?
The whole course?
Yes.
Yes.
In general,
the people in the class, there were probably 30 of us in the class,
mm-hmm.
and they were people that I would know for the rest of the Army.
People that you would come across?
Yes, and who would either I would work with or who would in some way influence my career. One of my classmates later became the head of the career management branch. And so, you know,
now who was that, Anne? What was her name?
Maida Lambeth.
M-E-H?
M-A-I-D-A.
M-E-I-D-A, okay. And she became head of career management.
Mm-hmm.
Was she someone who you worked for later on?
No, I never worked for her.
Okay.
But
you said there were about 30...
I think
in the class.
About 30.
Now, you gals lived on post, I'm sure.
Yes.
And did you socialize outside of class?
With each other?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so you're sort of more or less kind of becoming acquainted in addition to...
Well, we lived next... my suite mate was a major, and she had a room and a bedroom and a living room, and my bedroom connected to her living room.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually it became my living room too.
Right.
But
right.
When we started, it wasn't. I was a captain and she was a major, and it was her living room.
But as time went on.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
And we were up and down the hall together, and that was good too, because we also, there were young lieutenants living in the building. And they got to see some of the more senior officers and realize that we were having to work hard to get through that course. It was not easy.
Okay. It wasn't a skate.
No.
Did you have work that you had to do in the evenings to prepare and so forth? And were there tests?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Were there tests?
Okay. So this wasn't just to sit back and let it soak in.
It was not a ladies' course.
Okay. You had to engage.
Yes.
And was there any competition?
Yes.
Set up there? Okay. And how did you...
There was going to be someone who was the top student in the
uh-huh,
class.
Uh-huh.
And it was based on, test grades, scores, and other intangible things.
And did you sort of getting engaged and wrapped up in the competition, or were you pretty much angling to do the best you could and however it came out is how it came out? Or neither of those.
Well, like most people, I'd have liked to have been first.
Sure.
But it was a matter of doing it the best you could do.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had four major tests during the course. And then we were studying something that was reasonably geopolitical, and we had to make a major report on some area of the world, and then we had to write a staff study. So all of those, and we had to speak and teach. All of those things worked into the overall class standing.
So this was a multifaceted program that had that kept you running, I would
guess. Yes.
Okay. Did you graduate? Was there any kind of ceremony or?
Oh, heavens, you can't graduate without a ceremony.
I wondered. Do you remember that? What was it like?
Well, it was, we always graduated in the chapel because that was where we had the best seats, and, you know, it was more appropriate. And the band played, and we had a speaker, and we were granted our certificates, and the people, the top student was honored,
mm-hmm.
and friends and families all came. So it was marked as an important part.
Now, did family members of yours attend, Anne?
My mother and my brother came.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How was your mother doing at this point?
Oh, she was fine.
Was she terribly proud of you at this
point? Always.
I would think, yeah. I would think. and this was not, because it was in Alabama, this was not such a an extended trip for her.
No, okay. It wasn't bad.
Okay.
From South Georgia up here is not really a bad trip.
And she was in good health until her accident in 1964?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sure that this was an extremely, she was probably very, very proud of you, I imagine. And from the school, what happened in terms of your next posting?
I stayed as an instructor.
And was that kind of a plum position?
I asked for it.
Did you?
Uh-huh. I like to teach,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it would be a good assignment. And two of my good friends from the class stayed, so there were three of us. And so that was, I wanted to do it. The next thing we did, as soon as we were assigned, we were sent to Fort Benning to go to instructor training. You can't teach in the Army until they send you to instructor training somewhere.
Okay.
I've been through it three times.
And this would have been the second time, am I right?
Yes, I went through it in a sense before the first time I was at McClellan,
mm-hmm.
then this time, mm-hmm. and then in a later assignment when I was instructing again.
And how long were you down at Fort Benning?
I was down, I can't remember, the instructor training course is probably a couple of weeks.
Okay.
And then I stayed to go to nuclear weapons employment course, the classified portion of it, because that's what I was going to teach.
You were going to teach the nuclear weapons?
Yes.
Employment? Okay. So you, like Major King, had to take the classified?
Yes.
Okay. And can you tell me anything about that course or how it went, what the distinctions were?
Well, you were in a locked building all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't study when you went home because you couldn't take anything with you.
Okay, right.
And it was all done in that building. There were two of us women and the rest men. All the instructors were men, of course,
mm-hmm.
and the other woman was one of our classmates from the WAC advanced course.
Now, who was that?
Her name is Betty Fraser,
okay.
Fraser.
Uh-huh. Was she a captain as well?
She was major.
She was
the one with whom I shared the living room.
Oh, I see. Okay, so the two of you gals went off and took this course. Okay, I see.
And the other one went through the instructor training and then came back, and we had shared a little motel suite,
mm-hmm.
while we were there. So,
now, go ahead. You said you took the courses in a locked building and couldn't take anything off site.
Yes.
What kinds of things were they teaching you about? The types of weapons that were in the arsenal? And that
the
sort
types
of
weapons in the arsenal, but mostly the effects of them. How do you determine what the effect may be, and what it's, how you aim them,
mm-hmm.
How you figure their accuracy, that sort of stuff.
So was it a lot of math in there?
Not a lot of math. It was a lot of logic, I think.
Okay.
In a sense, but you had to learn the various terms like error and range and error of deflection and circular error probable, and how those three work with each other. And I'm talking with my hands.
Okay, you're illustrating. Okay.
But the thing I am most proud of is that I finished second in the class.
That's not too bad. How big was the class?
I don't know. There were probably 20 of us.
Uh-huh. So and you cottoned on to this.
Oh, yeah. I liked it. I thought it was fun.
Okay.
And the man who came out top was, I think, a field artilleryman who had every right to be the top.
Yes, absolutely. He'd been through some of this stuff before, only probably without in conventional weapons anyway. And upon returning to Fort McClellan, then you began as an instructor. Was there a set course that would start at a particular time that you then became part of the delivery of the curriculum?
We had two basic officer/OCS classes a year.
Okay.
And one advanced officer class. And so we taught both of them.
And, for example, how many lectures would you be giving? How long would you have in each class that their attention was devoted to what
well,
you were
teaching? The curriculum set up a program of instruction / curriculum
mm-hmm.
was set up so that they had a given number of hours of military customs and courtesies or a given number of hours of methods of instruction
right.
or whatever. And so you were assigned a course to teach. And so you taught all of it, but you were assigned more than one course
mm-hmm.
at the same time. So you would be teaching one thing to the basic officers and another thing to the advanced officers.
And you would be delivering these simultaneously.
Well, not exactly simultaneously.
Well, but over the course, you would say from January to June, you might be teaching in both of the
yes.
of the schools. You would be delivering different content in both of the schools.
And the classes were sometimes 3-hour long, 3-hour blocks.
Uh-huh.
And that was particularly true in nuclear weapons because there was a lot of practical stuff. And so you would go in and you would hold forth for 3 hours.
That's a lot of teaching time.
And I happen to like to teach early in the morning
mm-hmm.
because you get it over with. And that was fine because a lot of people didn't want to, so I could often do most of my teaching in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the difficulties was when you had a class of lieutenants, every one of them had to teach a class that you had to prepare that person for, and you taught them how to do it. Then you watched them dry run it and tell them what they could do better, and then you went and graded them on the actual instruction. That was time-consuming.
Absolutely, yes, because there's both the hours spent in the classroom watching delivery, and then there's the
yeah.
advising element of it, too. Did you like doing this, Anne?
Yeah. I didn't like that a lot, that particular aspect, but as far uh-huh. as teaching is concerned, I like it, and I like to teach adults.
And did you have it in mind that you might try to extend this particular assignment that you had?
No.
No, you wanted something
yeah.
ready for a change?
You do that, and it's time for something else.
Okay. And your next assignment was with G3, is that right?
Yes, at 3rd Army Headquarters at Fort McPherson, Georgia.
Now, am I right in thinking Fort McPherson is south of Atlanta?
Yes.
Somewhere? Okay. That's also the headquarters of the 3rd Army.
Yeah.
Okay. What were you supposed to be doing with G3 there?
Well, I was a plans and training officer, and at the time we were having a huge buildup for Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and that got to be a major part of my concern. Where are we going to put them? How are we going to get clothes on them? How are we going to train them? We had troops living in tents because there were just not enough barrack space because they were expanding the army so much then. And we had post commanders vying for more troops because the more troops you have, the bigger your mission, the more money you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So just And it was, in a way, a difficult time.
You arrived there at what point? Do you remember the date?
No.
1965, sometime. So the deployments.
Probably the summer of 65.
Okay, so the big deployments on the of ground forces had already begun.
Yeah.
It was a difficult time because there was so much going on.
That's one thing, and then another thing was there was I just remembered
mm-hmm.
there was a project going on called Project 100,000. Anyway, they were experimenting with bringing in many more lesser qualified soldiers and training them, and that was a.
Go ahead.
It was difficult because you were having to develop programs for people who weren't as capable of learning, and I think it was a social experiment. Let us see if the Army can instill ambition in people who may not have had it before and give them skills they didn't have before. And on top of everything else, I think a difficult time for a social experiment, but probably a good idea.
Now, when you say less qualified soldiers, how do you
academically.
Mean?
Academically.
Okay, so not high school graduates?
Maybe not high school graduates, and maybe with lowered minimum test scores.
Were these people ones who had been, in effect, rejected by earlier drafts?
I don't know.
Okay. But your sort of end of this project was to try to develop...
Our end was watching it and
okay.
reporting on it
uh-huh.
and... keeping up with how it was going on.
Okay. And so how would you do that? Establish some kind of markers?
Reporting systems.
Uh-huh.
And,
uh-huh.
And there were all sorts of experimental things that were going on that it was in the early stages of the HALO program for jumping out of airplanes. You jump out high and open low.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting, too, because we had to, there were a lot of coordinations with the G1, the personnel people, and most of the people in G3 don't have, because their plans and operations, don't have a lot of brief for the personnel people. So I was the go-between because I could talk to both of them.
And you'd had experience in G1.
Yeah, I could talk personnel.
And so did you find yourself trying to explain, you know, the apples to the oranges and vice versa?
Well, sometimes just trying to make them understand each other's problems.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Or concerns.
Now, where did you live while you were working at Fort McPherson? Did you have a BOQ there as well?
No, I had an apartment.
Okay, so you were off base?
Yes.
Okay. How did you locate the apartment? Was it somewhere that a lot of officers had stayed? And
no, I think I probably got an apartment finder, you know,
okay.
a brochure or something. I don't remember.
Where was it? Do you recall?
It was about 2 miles from Post.
Okay. Did you enjoy living back in the, you know, more or less Atlanta area? I know that's a ways south, but
oh yes.
Was it nice to be back there?
Oh yes, very nice to be back. My brother was living there at the time,
uh-huh.
and as he always is.
As he always is, right?
So. In fact, the day my household goods were delivered, he went to the apartment and accepted them for me because I was still in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I enjoyed being there.
Thinking back to that time when you were living off base, can you describe what race relations were like in this time period? In you know, south of Atlanta, in that area.
Well, where I lived was strictly a white area,
mm-hmm.
and an apartment. I was sort of, you know, a strange thing to most of the people in the apartment because they saw me coming and going in uniform, and most of them hadn't seen that a lot.
Sure. Yeah.
And the race relations, when I was at McClellan the last time, in the advanced course, that was when things were bad, because all of the bad things were happening in Birmingham.
Yeah, okay.
And we had a bus burning in Anniston. And I recall that we were specifically told not to go off post.
This is while you were in the school?
This is while I was in the school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have seen over my years of being in this area, I have seen such changes. I'm going to go way back. When I was a lieutenant, if we had an enlisted woman who perhaps needed to go into Anniston to get shoes because the Army couldn't fit her.
Yes.
I would not take one of the African-American troops to town. We would get an African-American NCO to take the person to town because we didn't want to stir up controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And how things have changed in these 50 years is
yes.
just, you know, people who think there is no change are wrong. There's been a lot of change. And so, but when I was living in Atlanta, I was not conscious of it then.
Mm-hmm. Did it come up again later? Did you see much, for example, later when you were in Washington?
No.
When
I was in Washington, when Martin Luther King was killed.
Yes, do you remember that?
Oh, do I really remember that?
Tell me everything you can recall about that, Ann. Where were you? And
I was in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And the week before, I think, I had driven through the grounds of the National Cathedral, and Martin Luther King was speaking, and it was being broadcast. You could hear it outside. And so in very shortly after that, he was killed. And I went out to the river entrance of the Pentagon and looked over toward the district.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the saddest things I have ever seen was black smoke rising over the Capitol. And that was just so sad. And the next day, I went over to Fort Myer pick up some laundry, and it was a lady who worked there, an African-American woman, and I knew she lived in the district,
mm-hmm.
and I asked her, I said, how was it yesterday, and she told me about having to walk home because she couldn't get any public transportation, and with the difficulty of it, but I was there during the march on the Pentagon. I was the things that were going on during my various tours in Washington were just, you know, historic.
Absolutely, yes. And that's something that we'll include as we go forward.
One day when my second tour in Washington, I was going to work one morning, and some. I worked in the building with the energy department in the district, and there were some protesters standing out there giving out anti-nuclear stuff
mm-hmm.
and blocking my getting to work and making me use the wrong steps. You know, those sort of annoying things. And I refused to take his little brochure. And he says, well, don't I have a right to express my opinion? And I said, yes, and I have a right not to take it. So...
Did he have a comeback, or was he kind of surprised?
No.
I thought not. that would be when you were working, that would be in the late 70s?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The Pope came then, and I was working across the street from the Smithsonian, so I got to see his throne. And then we had a big march of Christians going on, and then we had the tractors. Exciting time to be in Washington.
Absolutely. I mean, there really isn't a time that's dull, I think, to be in Washington. But the things that you recount are extremely interesting. When Dr. King spoke at the National Cathedral, did you hear him, Ann?
No, I could only hear him outside because I had some friends visiting,
mm-hmm.
and I was showing them the cathedral.
I see.
And just rode past.
And it happened to be going on
as you
came by. What did you make of Dr. King? Did you have an opinion about what he was doing?
Yes. I think I might not have agreed with him all the time,
mm-hmm.
but he was going about something that needed to be done in a better way than most people.
Mm-hmm. Now, by that, are you talking about his
nonviolence,
mm-hmm.
even though there was violence? And I was there one of my tours when Resurrection City was in being, when he was there. That was the I Have a Dream speech, I guess,
mm-hmm.
around that period. And so there had to be someone, I think, to do the sorts of things, and it had to be someone with charisma and it could get things done. And I read his full speech, the letter from Birmingham jail,
mm-hmm.
and I was just, and it's fairly recently, I was so impressed with how he put it together from his head while he was in jail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you been to the King Center?
No.
There in Atlanta?
No.
It's worth going to.
I haven't been to the Carter Center either.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. That's also worth going to.
There's a lot I haven't seen in it.
Well, I recommend both of those. When next you're in Atlanta with time on your hands and nothing to
do. That's the problem.
I know. I know it is. Let's talk a little bit more about Fort McPherson. Your work there lasted for the regular 2-year period?
I wasn't there the full 2 years.
Okay. Why was that?
Because the director of the Women's Army Corps retired, and Elizabeth Hoisington became the director, and she asked me to go to Washington and work for her.
How did she know you?
She had known me at Fort McClellan.
Okay. Under what circumstances? At the
school?
She
came in as the White Center commander when I was there teaching.
Okay. So she had seen you in action, as it were.
Well, she had seen me around.
Okay. What kind of relationship did you have with her? Just a kind of nodding sort of acquaintance?
No, it was closer than that.
Okay. Uh-huh.
I mean, she knew me well enough to know my name, and I knew her well enough to call her colonel.
Effectively, she pulled you up to be on her staff. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. What position did you take in Washington with her?
It was called Plans and Operations Officer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There was the director, the deputy director, the executive officer, and the junior officer. I was it. And a sergeant major. That was the office.
So she had a staff of maybe of what, four, five or six?
No, she had a staff of four.
Four, okay. That's incredible. I mean, that's amazing for someone in her position. That's just amazing. How did you get along with her?
I enjoyed her.
Mm-hmm.
I was not as efficient and as good as she would have liked me to have been.
Now, what does that mean, Ann?
That means it's hard to describe it. She, as a young officer, had the same job that I now had.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I could not live up to her, what she had done, or her expectations. Not that I could not. I did not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
what was she looking for that you didn't do? As you think back now, what do you think?
Probably she's... more ambition and more efficiency.
What was a day like for you?
Every day, first you had to get to the Pentagon.
Right, which wasn't always easy, is that right?
Yeah, well, frequently I took the bus.
Mm-hmm.
It was easier than driving.
Okay, right.
And we started each day with a staff meeting.
Okay.
And then the day was full of, one of the things I was responsible for was uniform programs, as in garments, uniform programs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are always meetings about something, about changing the uniform, doing something, and the other Army women's services were involved, like the Army Nurse Corps and the Army Medical Specialist Corps. So if there was somebody wanted to do something to a uniform, like get a new sweater, we would have meetings to discuss that. At the time, women were going to Vietnam.
Yes.
And we were having a hard time getting enough uniforms for them. And we were, and more and more women were coming in the Army. And it was just an effort to get uniforms. We were tracking them by ones and twos. Where are the overcoats that we can issue to the troops? And the women going to Vietnam had an increased allowance of uniforms because of the weather conditions. So I was involved with that a good bit. We also at the time had an exhibit unit that traveled the country, an officer, Inez Bailey, who later became director of the Women's Army Corps. She had a group of young enlisted women, and they traveled the country doing fashion shows. And it was a recruiting thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Periodically they would come back into the Washington area and have to get re-outfitted with uniforms and that sort of thing. So I'd get involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed my life in the Pentagon.
Where were you living in?
I was living in Arlington.
In an apartment?
Yes.
Okay. Whereabouts in Arlington? Just for those who might know the city.
Off of Columbia Pike.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you had not lived in Washington before.
No.
Was this quite exciting to be in the capital area? At the Pentagon each day, and
it was. Looking back on it, Washington changed so much between the two times I was there. I enjoyed it more the first time because it was easier to get around. You could go to Georgetown and find a place to park and wander. You could go to Alexandria, Old Town, and mm-hmm. it was just not nearly as congested as it is now.
Yeah. Yeah, when you said go to Georgetown and find somewhere to park, I just thought, oh, no. and did you have a car during this time period? Or?
Yes.
Okay, so you were able to get around on weekends and evenings by yourself.
My first chore was finding how to get into the parking lot at the Pentagon.
Well, how did they restrict that then? Did they have control?
No, just finding it.
My parking
place was in the south parking lot, and the only way I could get to the south parking lot was to go through the north parking lot. And I knew there had to be a better way.
Uh-huh.
And one Sunday, I just went out and rode around till I could find it.
Did you locate the way in?
Yes. And frequently, I did drive a good bit. And uh-huh. during that assignment, there was a woman attacked in one of the stairwells at the Pentagon, and after that they had a shuttle that would pick up women at the doors at night, mm-hmm. late afternoon, and take them to their cars. And it was a soldier with a shotgun rider, and they would wait until you got in your car and pulled out.
Did they, to your knowledge, solve the crime of the
I don't
assault?
Know.
But it changed things.
Yes, it changed things, mm-hmm. and it made them conscious of security.
Mm-hmm.
But the big mystery was remembering where your car was.
Right, I'm sure. It was a massive, massive parking lot.
And then having, when it was so hot and you had on your greens, mm-hmm. and having to walk out to the car and find it and get in a hot car, it was miserable.
Yes. What kind of building security was there at the Pentagon? Did you have to wear a badge or something to get in and out?
Not then.
Just walked in and out?
Walked in and out.
Nobody at the door? No metal detectors? No,
the
nothing.
Buses came in under the Pentagon. You got out and walked up.
Wow. That's extraordinary, too, to think of that. And if you don't mind, let's take a break here.
All right.